Chapter 3 Cabrillo gave the dark river another look before turning back to the abandoned hut they were using as a base. It was built on stilts partially over the water, and the ladder up to the single room was made of logs lashed together with fiber rope. It creaked ominously as he climbed, but it held his weight. The thatch roof was mostly gone, so the twilight sky was bisected by wooden trusses still covered in bark. "Coffee's ready," Mike Trono whispered and handed over a mug. Trono was one of the corporation's principal shore operators, a former pararescue jumper who'd gone behind enemy lines in Kosovo, Iraq, and Afghanistan to rescue downed pilots. Slight of build, with a mop of fine brown hair, he had quit the military to race offshore powerboats, only to find the adrenaline rush wasn't enough. Next to him slouched the large sleeping form of his partner in crime, Jerry Pulaski. Jerry was a qualified combat veteran, and it would be his responsibility to lug the 70-pound power pack once they found it. Rounding out the tight squad was Mark Murphy, also asleep. Murph's main job in the corporation was handling the Oregon's sophisticated weapons, and he could fight a ship like no one Juan had ever encountered, though he'd never been in the military. He was an MIT graduate with a fistful of letters after his name, including Ph.D., who'd taken his genius into the development of military hardware. Cabrillo had recruited him some time back with his best friend, Eric Stone, who was now Oregon's chief helmsman. Juan thought of them as the dynamic duo. When they were together, he could swear they communicated telepathically, and when they spoke in the arcane vernacular of their oft-played video games, he figured they were speaking in tongues. Both young men considered themselves geek chic, though few on the crew were too sure of the chic part. Mark had had his first real taste of close-quarter combat during the corporation's rescue of the Secretary of State, and Linda Ross's assessment was that he handled himself like a pro. Juan wanted him along on this mission in case there were any technical issues with the plutonium containment vessel. If there was a problem, Murph was the best the corporation had at figuring it out. In deference to the humidity, which made the air thick enough to practically drink, all four men were shirtless, their skins slathered in DEET against the hordes of insects circling just outside the mosquito net they had hung from the rafters. Sweat clung to the hair on Cabrillo's chest and snaked down his lean flanks. Where Jerry Pulaski had heavy slabs of muscle, Cabrillo had a swimmer's physique, with broad shoulders and a tapered waist. Not one to worry about what he ate, he kept himself trim by swimming countless laps in the Oregon's marble-lined swimming pool. "Another hour until sundown," Cabrillo said, taking a sip of the instant coffee cooked on a little folding stove. The taste made him look into the mug suspiciously. He'd grown accustomed to the gourmet Kona brewed aboard ship. "We have just enough light to get the RHIB ready. Leaving an hour later will put us at the border a little before midnight." "Just before the third watch takes over and the second's thinking about their beds," Mike said, then kicked Pulaski's ankle. "Up, sleeping beauty, your breakfast awaits." Jerry yawned broadly, stretching his thick arms over his head, his dark hair tousled from using his shirt as a pillow. "God, you sure are ugly to wake up next to." "Watch it, my friend. I've seen some of the girls you've dragged home." "Is that coffee?" Mark Murphy asked, rubbing sleep from his eyes. He usually kept his hair long, but for this mission Juan had had him cut it to a more practical length. "Calling it that is being generous," Cabrillo said, and gave the weapons genius his cup. After changing clothing, they assembled under the ramshackle hut. Tied to one of the stilts and lying dangerously low to the water was their river conveyance, a matte black-ridged hulled inflatable boat, or RHIB. It was essentially a fiberglass-bottomed craft with inflatable fenders ringing its gunwale for added buoyancy. Two massive outboards hung over the boat's transom. The only crew amenity was a stand-up cockpit shielded by bulletproof glass in the center of the 25-foot deck. It had been modified aboard the Oregon so it could fold flat. They had air freighted the RHIB in a steel container into Paraguay and loaded the crate directly onto a rented truck. Juan had no idea if the Argentines had spies watching its neighbors' airports for suspicious activity, but if he were in charge of the military dictatorship, he would. The truck was driven to an isolated town about 50 miles upriver from the Argentine border, and it was there they unloaded it and all the other gear they had brought along. Their current location was another 30 miles south of the town. Juan had opted for a riverine approach versus infiltrating Argentina by helicopter because radar coverage along the border was simply too tight, even flying nap of the earth, and because a tributary of this river ran less than 5 miles from their search target. The clincher was the fact that the cloud cover he'd seen on the pictures turned out to be a massive slash-and-burn logging operation close to where the satellite fragment crashed. The chances of being spotted were too great. He took a lesson from World War II, specifically Germany's Operation Greif at the outset of the Battle of the Bulge, in which English-speaking commandos crossed through the Allied lines during the opening hours of the fight in order to change signposts, disrupt traffic, and generally creating chaos among the Allied forces. Cabrillo recalled reading the story of one SS corporal who was part of Operation Greif. He admitted that crossing the lines during the battle was the most frightening part of the plan because gunfire was directed at them from both directions. Once on the other side, the German had written, he carried out his duties without the slightest fear, knowing his disguise and command of English would protect him. He hadn't been captured and was eventually wounded defending Berlin against the Russians. Cabrillo had no desire to get caught in a crossfire from nervous border guards, so rather than cross this particular line, he was going to go under it. The RHIB was loaded to the gunwales with iron plates, tons of them, enough to quadruple the shipping costs of sending the boat unladen. Mark Murphy and Eric Stone had figured out the exact amount needed to pull off Juan's stunt, and now they were about to find out if his two resident geniuses were right. Wordlessly, they got to work. Jerry and Mike installed the engine covers and made sure they were watertight, while Mark double-checked that all their dive bags full of equipment and weapons were securely tied down. After inspecting the open cabin for anything that might get damaged by immersion, Juan handed over the 4 Draeger rebreathers. Unlike scuba tanks, there was no telltale trail of bubbles from the German-made device. They worked by scrubbing carbon dioxide from the closed-loop system and adding oxygen from a small tank when gas ratios tipped dangerously. The men wore micro-thin black diving suits, not so much for thermal protection. The water was blood-warm, but to cover their white skin. Their dive shoes had thick rubber soles and detachable flippers in case they needed to leave the water in a hurry.
"Would be nice if we could do this closer to the border," Jerry Pulaski commented.
It was an observation hiding a mild complaint.
"Sure would be," Juan agreed, suppressing a grin.
Satellite pictures showed the next town on the river was 5 miles downstream. Again, if he was part of the Argentine junta, he would pay some local wharf rat to drop a dime if he saw or heard anything suspicious. In this part of the world, patriotism was a poor substitute for a full belly, so the team was in for a long night. Cabrillo turned to Murphy.
"You want the honors?"
"Hell no," Mark said. "If we got it wrong, you're going to make Eric and me pay for the boat."
Juan shrugged.
"Good point."
Standing chest deep in the current, he reached over one of the inflatable fenders and opened a release valve. Air hissed from the valve under high pressure until the black rubber was limp. He nodded to Jerry to do the same on the other side, and soon they had half of them emptied. Water sloshed over the gunwale as the boat sank deeper into the river. Cabrillo and Pulaski pushed down on the hull. The boat sank farther and remained submerged, though the bow soon rose to the surface. More air was released until the RHIB was neutrally buoyant and perfectly balanced. Not surprisingly, the calculations had been spot on. The team struggled into their rebreathers, fit full masks over their faces, and performed a communications check. There was little chance of running into crocodiles or caimans, but all had spear guns fitted into holsters strapped to their thighs. Juan sliced the rope securing the RHIB to the hut and let the current take them. With each man holding a line attached to the boat, they swam their ungainly charge into the middle of the river. To Cabrillo, it felt like they were trying to herd a hippopotamus. They stayed close to the surface for the first few miles, swimming lazily with the river's not insignificant current. This far from the light pollution of any cities, the sky was a vaulted dome of glittering stars, so bright and so numerous it seemed as though night in this part of the world was silver and not black. It was more than bright enough to see both banks of the river and to keep the wallowing boat in the center of the channel. Only when they neared the next village did the men dump air from their buoyancy compensators and take the RHIB down close to the bottom. Juan had taken a compass bearing before slipping below the surface, and he steered them by watching the dial's luminous face. It was an eerie feeling, swimming in water as dark as ink. With the temperature close to his own body's, it was as though he'd been denied all tactile sensation. They drifted for a mile, the men lazily finning to maintain steerage before Cabrillo ordered them back to the surface. The isolated village was well behind them, and they found they had the river to themselves. Even had there been traffic, their black gear, and the fact that only parts of their heads were exposed, would lead any native to believe the team was just a couple of branches being slowly swept down toward Argentina. Hours rolled away. It was a faint glow emanating around the next bend that told them they were approaching the border. During their briefing, they had all seen satellite shots of the area. On the Paraguay side was a 300-foot concrete quay fronting tumble-down warehouses and a customs shed. The sleepy little town was maybe four streets deep and equally wide. A white-steepled church was the tallest building. In response to the troop buildup, the local military commander had brought a detachment of soldiers to town. They were camped just north of the village in a field that ran right to the river's red clay bank. The Argentine side was almost identical, except there were at least 500 soldiers garrisoned there, and they had strengthened their position by deploying searchlights on spidery towers to sweep the Black River and strung thickets of concertina wire on the dirt road connecting the two towns. The satellite pictures showed two slim boats tied to the pier near where it looked like the military was headquartered. To Juan's eye, they appeared to be Boston whalers, and if he had to guess, they were probably armed with machine guns and possibly grenade launchers. They would be a problem if things got hairy. Keeping close to the bottom, but not touching it so the hull didn't disturb the silt and leaves and kick up a telltale wake, the men swam through the formidable gauntlet. They knew they had reached the Argentine position when a shaft of light pierced the dark water. They were too deep and the river too muddy for anyone on shore to see them, but they steered away from the silvery glow anyway. On the surface, the two men in the tower watched whatever the beam revealed. Empty water slowly flowing southward. Cabrillo and the team remained submerged for another hour, only coming up when the border was miles behind them. It took another hour of drifting silently to reach a nameless tributary seen earlier from the satellite pictures. This time the men had to work against the current, wrestling the unwieldy craft against the flow. 20 minutes of struggle gained them only 100 yards, but Juan called a halt, judging they were far enough upstream to keep them from potentially prying eyes. He sighed as he stripped off the heavy dragger set and laid it into the half-sunk boat.
"That feels good."
"My fingertips look like white prunes," Mark complained, holding them up to the moonlight.
"Quiet," Juan admonished in a whisper.
"Okay, boys, you know what's next. The quicker we get it done, the more shut-eye we get."
The steel plates used to lower the RHIB's profile weighed 50 pounds each, a not unreasonable load for men in peak physical condition, but there were hundreds that had to be lifted over the gunwale and dumped into the river. The men worked like machines, Jerry Pulaski especially. For every plate Murph or Mike Trono got over the side, he moved too. Slowly, so slowly, the boat began to emerge like some slimy amphibian from the primordial ooze. Once the sides cleared the surface, Murph engaged a battery-powered pump. The steady stream of water sounded like a babbling brook. It took an hour, and when they were finished, all four rolled onto the still wet deck and lay like dead men. Juan was the first to rouse himself. He told his men to sleep and let Jerry know he would have second watch. The night sounds of the jungle were punctuated by the occasional snore. 2 hours later, shortly after dawn, the RHIB left the small tributary and returned to the river proper. The air cells they had emptied remained limp, but on such smooth water and with such a light load, it wouldn't affect the boat's capabilities. The four men now wore Argentine combat fatigues with the insignia of the 9th Brigade and their trademark maroon berets. The 9th was a well-trained and outfitted paramilitary unit that answered only to General Corazon. In other words, a death squad. Pretending to be a 9th Brigade officer, Cabrillo knew he would be able to talk them into or out of any situation that could arise. He stood at the RHIB's helm, wearing aviator-style glasses favored by members of the 9th, his beret at a cocky angle on his head. Behind him, the twin outboards threw up a volcanic wall of white froth while the bow planed over the still surface like a rocket. Mike and Murph stood at his sides, Heckler and Koch machine pistols, a 9th Brigade staple, slung across their backs. Jerry was still curled up on the fiberglass floorboards like a dog, somehow able to sleep despite the motor's roar. The speedometer quivered just below 40 miles per hour. 20 minutes downriver, they came to their first village. It was impossible to tell how long ago it had been destroyed. The amount of vegetation creeping into the burned-out shells of thatched huts led Juan to think months rather than weeks. Land behind the village that had been cleared for agriculture was also succumbing to the jungle's intractable advance.
"I know what those guys must have felt going upriver in Apocalypse Now," Mike said.
There were no bodies lying on the ground. Animals had seen to that shortly after the assault, but the savagery was still in clear abundance. The hamlet's score of cement-block buildings had been destroyed by high explosives. Chunks of concrete had been blown as far as the river's edge, and the few remaining sections of wall were riddled with machine gun holes. There were countless impact craters from the mortar fire used to drive the frightened people into their fields, where the Argentines would have set up a perimeter picket of men. The villagers would have raced into a slaughter.
"Good God,"
Murph gasped as they continued past.
"Why? Why did they do this?"
"Ethnic cleansing," Juan replied, his mouth a tight, grim line. "This far north, the villagers were probably Indians. Intel reports I've seen say the government in Buenos Aires wants to eradicate the last few pockets of natives remaining in the country. And to give you an idea of the characters we're impersonating," he nodded in the direction of the little town, "that's most likely 9th Brigade handiwork." "Lovely," Mike spat. He'd tucked his beret into a shoulder epaulet so his fine hair blew free around his head. "Same thing's going on in the cities and towns. Anywhere they find natives, they drag them out and ship them off to either labor camps here in the Amazon, or they just simply disappear. This place is a mix of Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan."
"How many Indians are left?"
"There were about 600,000 before the coup. God only knows how many have already been killed, but if this regime stays in power for a few more years, they're all going to end up dead." They passed a ferryboat, lumbering its way slowly upstream. It was big enough for 8 vehicles and maybe 40 passengers on its upper deck. The trucks aboard were all painted in camouflage colors, and the men lining the rail were soldiers. They waved over at the speeding RHIB, shouting greetings in Spanish. Keeping in character, the three men standing at the helm didn't deign to respond. When the Argentine soldiers were close enough to recognize the maroon berets, their happy calls fell to instant silence, and most of them suddenly had the need to see what was happening on the other side of the old craft. There was little other traffic on the river, mostly hand-built pirogues with single paddlers working along the bank in search of fish. Juan felt bad when they were caught up in the RHIB's churning wake, but slowing down would have been the last thing a 9th Brigader would do. Truth of it was, they probably would have aimed for the dugout canoes and rammed their occupants under the water. 2.5 hours of hard running down the river brought them to a tributary about half the size of the main branch, the Rio Rojo, and because of the high iron content in the soils upstream, the water was indeed a reddish-brown, like a bloody stain that spread into the current. Pulaski was awake by now, and he and Mike had been scanning the river for any sign that they were being watched. There was nothing but the river and the jungle, which was a solid wall of intertwined vegetation.
"Clear," Mike called over the engine's growl.
"Clear," Jerry echoed at the bow and lowered his binoculars. Juan cut power just enough to make the sharp turn and opened the throttles again as soon as the bow pointed upstream. The Rio Rojo was less than 50 yards wide, and the towering jungle seemed to meet overhead, filtering the sunlight with a greenish tinge. It was like they were making their way up a tunnel. Their wake caromed off the dirt banks, eroding clots of mud that fell into the water and dissolved. They started upstream, keeping the speed down because, in less than 5 minutes, they came across an expected towboat hauling logs down from the highlands. The boat was a wooden-hulled, bow-heavy scow with black smoke belching from its exhaust and more smoke coiling from the engine housing at the stern. The trees were left floating in the water with their perimeter logs chained together to keep the whole mass intact. Cabrillo estimated there were at least 220-foot lengths of what looked to him to be mahogany. He figured a larger load would be too cumbersome in such a narrow river.
"No radio mast," Mark Murphy said.
"Probably as a sat phone," Juan replied. "But I'm not worried about them reporting us. He can tell we're 9th Brigade, and he won't want any trouble from us." They stayed far to the right of the channel as they passed the lumber boat. Neither crews made any gesture of greeting. In fact, the tug's 3-man crew kept their eyes pointed decidedly downstream the entire time. Once clear, Juan opened the throttles further, but had to slow again just moments later. Another nearly identical boat appeared ahead. This one was making its way around a tight bend and was well into Cabrillo's side of the river. Tradition would be for Juan to idle his boat until the floating logjam made its turn and straightened out. But arrogant soldiers of an elite paramilitary group wouldn't care one bit about riverine customs. In Spanish, Juan shouted, "Stop where you are and let us pass."
"I cannot," the boat's captain yelled back.
He hadn't bothered to look to see who was addressing him. He was watching the shifting mass of logs edging closer and closer to the inside bank. If they rammed into the shore, it was possible that his boat wouldn't have the power to pull them free. It wasn't an uncommon occurrence, and it could take hours for the crew to unchain some of the logs from the bundle in order to free themselves, and hours more to set the load right again.
"I'm not asking, I'm telling," Juan said, letting anger drop his voice to a snarled hiss.
One of the deckhands tapped the boat's captain on the shoulder. The man finally looked over at the RHIB with its crew of armed soldiers in maroon berets. He went a little pale under his 2 days' growth of beard.
"Okay, okay," he said with the resignation of the powerless in the face of oppression.
He throttled back, and the current immediately slammed his load into the riverbank. A dozen logs as thick around as oil barrels were thrown onto shore. The impact snapped a section of chain, hurling bits of its rusted links through the air. The oily workboat slowly came across the current, pressing its load deeper into the bank, while at the same time opening the channel for Cabrillo and the RHIB. Logs that had broken free were already drifting downstream. Keeping in character, Juan threw the hapless men a mocking salute and firewalled the throttles.
Murph said, "It's going to take the better part of the day to clean that up."
"Had we waited for him to clear the corner, he would have been suspicious," Mike Trono countered. "Better them inconvenienced than us questioned. Juan speaks Spanish like a native, but I get lost with the menu at a Mexican restaurant."
They continued upstream, passing one more boat towing a mass of timber, before the handheld GPS said they were as close to the crash site as the river would take them. After cruising for another quarter mile, they found a small feeder stream, and Juan backed the boat into it. There was barely enough room for the RHIB's hull, and the jungle scraped against the vessel's rubber sides. Jerry Pulaski tied a line around a moldering stump, and Juan cut the engines. After so many hours of their throaty roar, It took several seconds for Cabrillo to hear jungle sounds through the ringing in his ears. Without being told, the men set about camouflaging the boat, hacking fronds and leaves from different trees and bushes, and creating an intricate screen over the RHIB's bow. When they were done, the craft was all but invisible from 5 feet away. "Well, boys," Juan said as they gathered their communications equipment and other gear together, including a specially made harness for Jerry to carry the plutonium power cell, "our leisurely cruise downriver is over. Now the real slog begins. I'll take point. Mike, you've got the drag slot. Keep low and quiet. We have to assume the RGs have their own teams out here looking for the debris, or at least investigating. Stay sharp." The men, their faces smeared with camouflage grease paint, looking as fearsome as any native warrior, nodded silently as they stepped from the boat onto the spongy shore. They started inland, following a game trail that ran roughly parallel to the small stream. The temperature was a solid 80 degrees, with the humidity a few notches higher. In just a few minutes, their pores were running like faucets. For the first mile, Cabrillo felt every muscle cramp and ache from their time in the river, but as they forged on, the countless laps he'd swum over the course of his life began to show. He moved more lithely, his boots merely brushing the loamy soil. Even his stump was feeling good. He'd always been more accustomed to wide open spaces, the sea or the desert, but his other senses were making up for what his eyes could not see. There was a faint trace of wood smoke in the air, from the logging operation, he knew, and when a bird's startled cry carried down from the jungle canopy, he paused and waited to learn what had disturbed it. Was it startled by a predator, or by something it saw walking the same path as Juan's team? The mental acuity required for jungle stalking was as physically taxing as the effort to slide through the dense foliage. Something off to his left caught Juan's eye. He immediately dropped to a knee, hands signaling the men strung out behind him to do likewise. Cabrillo studied the spot that had attracted his attention through his machine pistol's iron sights. The quick squirt of adrenaline into his veins seemed to heighten his vision. He perceived no movement, not even a breeze rustling the leaves. This far below the canopy, air movement was a rarity. He cautiously swayed back, changing his angle of view in minute increments. There. A dull flash of metal. Not the slick black sheen of a modern weapon trained on him, but the pewter shimmer of old aluminum left out in the elements. According to the GPS, they were still several miles from where the power cell was projected to have landed, and he wondered for a moment if this was other debris from the doomed satellite. Still in a crouch, and with the MP5 tucked hard against his shoulder, he moved off the trail, confident that what he was taking away from his own peripheral vision would be covered by his men. He approached with the patience of one of the jungle cats. 5 feet away, he saw the outline of something large through the undergrowth. Whatever this was, it wasn't part of the doomed orbiter. He used his weapon's barrel to move aside a clump of vines hanging from a tree and grunted in surprise. They had discovered what looked like the cockpit of a downed plane. The windshield was long gone and creepers had infiltrated, snaking around seats and bulkheads like a cancerous growth. But what really held his attention was what lay in the co-pilot's seat. There was little left of the body, just a brown-green skeleton that would soon dissolve into its chair. Its clothing had long since rotted away, but lying in the pelvic girdle and shining brightly in the diffused sunlight was a brass strip that Juan knew had been the guy's zipper. He whistled softly, and seconds later Mark Murphy and Jerry Pulaski approached. Mike would remain near the trail, watching their six.
"What do you think?" Juan asked quietly. "Looks like this plane's been here a while," Jerry said, swatting at a mouse-sized bug that had landed on his neck.
Mark's expression was thoughtful for a moment, and then his eyes widened.
"This isn't a plane," he said with awe in his voice. "This is the Flying Dutchman."
"Forgive my ignorance, but wasn't the Dutchman a ghost ship?" Pulaski replied.
"The Flying Dutchman was a blimp," Mark told him, and pointed.
Look between the seats. See that big wheel? That's for controlling a blimp's pitch. Rotate it forward, it engages the elevator on the fin assembly, and she goes nose down. Move it back, and the nose rises. What makes you think this is the Flying Dutchman and not some lost Navy patrol from World War II? Because we're 1,000 miles inland from both the Atlantic and the Pacific, and the Flying Dutchman went missing while looking for a lost city in the jungle.
Okay, Juan said. Go back and tell it from the beginning. Mark couldn't tear his eyes off the airship's shattered gondola.
When I was a kid, I kinda had a thing for blimps and zeppelins. It was just a fad, you know, a hobby. Before that, it was locomotives from the steam age.
Seeing the expressions staring at him, he added,
Look, I admit it. I was a geek.
Was? Jerry deadpanned.
Anyway, I read a lot of books about airships, their history. Like the story of the L-8, a Navy patrol blimp that took off from San Francisco in August of 1942. A couple of hours into a routine patrol, the two-man crew reported seeing an oil slick. A couple hours after that, the blimp floated back over the coast, minus the men. The only clue was that two life jackets were missing.
What's that got to do with this? Juan asked a little impatiently. Mark Murphy was the smartest guy Cabrillo had ever met, but with that came his tendency to go off on tangents that highlighted his near-photographic memory.
Well, another lost blimp story is the Flying Dutchman. I hope I'm remembering this right. After the war, a former Navy blimp pilot and some of his buddies bought a surplus airship to use as an aerial platform to fly over the South American jungle in search of an Incan city, most likely El Dorado. They converted the blimp to fly on hydrogen, which is insanely explosive, but it was something they could make themselves using electrolysis.
Treasure hunters? Pulaski asked dubiously.
I didn't say they were right, Mark replied on the defensive. I'm only saying they were real.
This is all well and good, Cabrillo said, backing away from the ruined cockpit and its grisly occupant. I've marked the location on the GPS, but we've got a mission to perform.
Give me 5 minutes, Mark pleaded.
Juan thought for a second, nodded. Murph grinned his thanks. He crawled through the opening where the gondola's door had been ripped off when the airship crashed into the jungle. To his left were the two pilot seats and controls. To the right was the cabin proper. It had the neat economy and efficiency of a travel trailer. There were two bunk beds, a tiny galley with an electric burner, and a dozen storage lockers. He opened each in turn, rummaged around for any clues, and moved on when all he found were clots of mildew and mold or old surplus mess kits the men must have used to make their meals. In one locker he found the metal remains of a climbing harness. The webbing and ropes had dissolved to goo, but the steel remained unchanged over the years. He knew instinctively that they had used the gear to lower one of their own out the gondola for ground reconnaissance. He finally hit pay dirt when he opened the rusted remains of a coffee can that had been left on the little dinette table. He cursed himself for not realizing its significance immediately. The can would have tumbled to the cabin floor when the blimp crashed. There was no way it should be on the table unless someone had placed it there. A survivor. Inside, he discovered a white rubber sheath about 6 inches in length. It took him a moment to realize it was a condom. By the feel of it, there was something stuffed inside. Papers, most likely. A final log entry? The open end had been knotted shut. After 60 years lying out here, this wasn't the time or place to open it. He would need the preservation equipment on the Oregon if he had any chance of learning more. He carefully sealed the prophylactic in a waterproof pouch and tucked it into his fanny pack.
Time's up, Juan said. The jungle was so thick that his voice was disembodied, yet he stood only a few yards away.
I'm done. Mark emerged from the gondola. With a last look back, he vowed to find the names of the men who had crashed here and inform their surviving relatives.